Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
In his profile of J.D. Vance for The Atlantic magazine, the writer and journalist George Packer says Vance's memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, came out at the last possible moment to shape a national conversation. Now, it's hard to know exactly what Vance wanted to do with the book. He hadn't yet decided to run for office. But Packer says he had risen from family chaos and Midwestern decline to the elite world of liberal academia, and he had come out of it all with a voice perfectly tuned to moderate conservatism. But Vance was also a striver, someone who knew how to read the moment and shape himself to fit it. Packer says this ability to socialize himself into new beliefs has been a pattern throughout his career. So Hillbilly Elegy was published just as Donald Trump was elected in 2016, on the cusp of this new era, the rise of MAGA politics and online aggression. And Packer says the book belonged to an era that just no longer exists. So Vance adapted, like he always did.
So two things happened at once. He becomes a celebrity. Trump becomes president. Suddenly, there's a roadblock in the path of J.D. Vance's ambitions. The Republican Party has embraced a candidate who he had opposed. So in January of 2017, he gathered a handful, maybe a dozen fellow conservatives, fellow, you know, you could say reform conservatives, not traditional conservatives, at the Washington office of the Hoover Institution. And essentially, the topic was the future of J.D. Vance in the Trump presidency and how he could have a future, and whether there was anything in Trump's populism that could be salvaged, that could become part of J.D. Vance's politics. A week later, he goes to Chicago to speak at David Axelrod's Institute of Politics.
So it's a privilege to be here with J.D. Vance.
And he's interviewed there and gives a really quite impressive performance.
I didn't vote for Trump. I am hopeful, like I think most Americans, that he'll be successful because his success is now the country's success. But I didn't vote for Hillary either.
Taking audience questions about Hillbilly Elegy, about Trump.
Even for me, as problematic as I saw a lot of Trump's rhetoric and his ideas on how to fix some of these problems, I agreed with him that the problems were there.
About it was America really at that moment.
You know, race definitely played a role in the 2016 election. I think that race will always play a role in our country. It's just sort of a constant fact of American life.
But at one point, he says, you've got to remember to pay attention to Trump's content, not his tone.
Again. But if you go to one of his rallies, it's maybe 5% him being really outrageous and offensive, and 95% him talking about, here are all the things that are wrong in your community, here's why they're wrong, and I'm going to bring back jobs. That was the core thesis of Trump's entire argument. And so it's just, it strikes me as a little bizarre to chalk it up.
So Vance is suddenly edging away from his bitter opposition to Trump now that Trump is president and kind of taking a few steps toward embracing Trump. But it took, I would say, 3 years for the process to be completed before he saw the light and found salvation as a full-blown MAGA Trump Republican. I mean, one version would be it's utterly cynical. He sees that he has no future in politics except with Trump. And I have no doubt there's a pretty strong dose of that. But I don't know that people's minds work quite that way, quite so simply. And it would be possible to say, well, maybe Vance was saying to himself, my own people voted for this guy. My Ohio neighbors, members of my own family, my cousins in Eastern Kentucky, they all voted for this guy. Maybe I should rethink it and try to understand what they see in him and why they think he's the answer to their problems. That would be, you know, a more generous version. And my guess is, knowing human nature as I have come to do in my life, it's a mix. It's opportunistic, it's cynical, it's driven by political ambition, but it may be rationalized or justified by his sense that what he has to do as a politician is see what his people, as he calls them over and over in Hillbilly Elegy, what his people want and need. And maybe what they want and need is Trump. So maybe he'd better figure out why.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. George Packer is with us today. His profile in The Atlantic is called The Talented Mr. Vance. Packer told us he set Vance's rise against the backdrop of American decline. And Vance poses this problem, he says in the article, and at the core of it is a question about character.
Yeah, the question about Vance is, what does he really believe in? Who is he? What is at his core? Because in a few short years, he did a complete 180 in the way he talked and in what he said. He went in 2016 as the author of Hillbilly Elegy from being a thoughtful, rather soft-spoken, nuanced, and I would say very appealing writer, thinker, speaker who had a complex view of America's social problems and who thought Donald Trump was absolutely not the solution. In fact, he was, as he put it, cultural heroin for the white working class. To 4 years later, an absolutely vituperative, extreme MAGA Republican who went beyond even Trump in some of the things he was willing to say. So what happened there? How are we to judge him? And there are different ways. And I think in the piece, I've tried to give him as much of a benefit of the doubt as a fair-minded person could. And yet I still have to convict him of a pretty profound self-betrayal.
It's interesting. You say that that question about his character is probably unanswerable, despite, as you say, the kind of, as you say, the conviction you offer in the piece. But why do you think unanswerable? Is it just the obvious answer because none of us can see into anyone else's heart? Or is it that you just couldn't find enough clues that gave you a sense of exactly what the answer might be to his motives?
Well, it might have helped if he'd been willing to talk to me, which he wasn't.
Because right.
I would have tried to talk to him in a way that didn't convict him, but that tried to understand him. But he didn't want that. No, I think it's the unknowability, the real jumble of motives that drive people who are in public like J.D. Vance, who may well have a strong impulse toward opportunism because they're ambitious, but who quickly justify it to themselves and to the world and come to believe the justification. I mean, very few people can be consciously, persistently false about themselves. And instead, they begin to change and believe that perhaps they were this way all along and everyone else has changed and they've just been true to themselves. I think that's likelier how someone like Vance thinks about his about face. But it is the kind of the mystery of him. But what I tried to do with the piece was to show how the mystery of J.D. Vance is more a story about what's happened to this country. I see him as like the protagonist of a novel about the last quarter century of American life. And it's not a very pretty picture.
I think that it's interesting he wouldn't speak with you. He's grappled with others who have raised questions about his motives. I'm sure he knows your work, obviously. I'm sure he respects your insights. And it made me wonder just why you think he didn't want to talk. What was your pitch like? How did you describe what you wanted to talk about? What do you – and I don't know, what kind of response did you get? Did you get a response directly from him? Did you get it from his people? Like, what was that part like?
I got a sort of, we'll think about it, from his press secretary, and then there never was a definitive response. And I kept trying, and there kept being a non-definitive response. And finally, I understood that that was the response, which was no. The pitch was, you say you're a post-liberal populist. What does that mean to you? What writers have you been influenced by? You know, Patrick Deneen, Adrian Vermeul. I wanted to get into his ideas, because Vance is intellectual. He really does care about and is interested in ideas, and he reads, or at least he used to read. I don't know that anyone at that level of politics still reads, but he's written essays about his conversion to Catholicism that cited Augustine, Aquinas, and the literary theorist René Girard. So I wanted to ask him about all of that, and I thought that would be a conversation he would welcome, because he cares about that stuff, and because I've read those people too. But the non-answer was no, because at this point in his career, Vance has nothing to gain from talking to me, and perhaps something to lose. Everything in his future depends on absolutely no daylight between him and the man who made him vice president. And so a conversation with a non-conservative Atlantic magazine writer might well create a little bit of daylight, and he didn't want that.
Let me come back to what you describe as that sort of literary quality of Vance's story that you just mentioned. You say a novelist who wanted to, give a sense of the decline of the American empire might invent a character like J.D. Vance. Say a little bit more about that, because his life, as you describe, covers kind of all of those themes. Say a little bit more about the literary quality of the arc in that story of J.D. Vance.
The more I read of his, the more I watched his interviews and podcasts, the more I thought about him, the more I began to feel as if I was reading about a fictional character, someone out of a novel about American politics. Because, my God, I mean, the incredible ascent from absolutely nowhere to nearly the top of power. But along the way, all of the key worlds of the last quarter century in America, from the post-industrial Midwest, a dying steel town in Ohio, to the Marine Corps in Iraq during the bloodiest years of the war, although he did not see combat. He was a public affairs enlisted man. Then the Ivy League and the meritocracy of Yale Law School, where he meets his future wife and meets the people who are going to make him. And all along, he keeps meeting the right people and being made and remade. He goes to Silicon Valley because Peter Thiel is someone he's met at Yale, and Thiel invites him to come work for him. And Peter Thiel, this powerful venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and right-wing thinker, has a huge influence on Vance. So Vance gets into tech instead of going off to a more normal career in law. And then he becomes friendly with Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump Jr. after he makes his switch to MAGA. And then finally to Trump himself, who sort of forgives him for all the nasty things that Vance had said about him. And so all along, he's one of these ambitious, talented, resourceful characters who passes from one world to another and keeps rising and knows exactly how to thrive in each of these worlds. But what the story also shows you is an American decline. Because let's look at these worlds. I mean, we're talking about the deindustrialization of the heartland, which is a huge economic disaster, a social disaster. We're talking about the forever wars, another disaster. We're talking about the Ivy League, which is this hyper-competitive, leader-making entity that has sort of failed the country, you could say, has failed to really have a more civic or even national vision of its own role. Instead, it's just about making people wealthy and powerful. And then you get to MAGA. And what is that? To me, MAGA is the stew of American politics at its most noxious. And by the end of the story, Vance is swimming in it. He's thriving in it. So at each step of the way, while he's rising, America is falling. And to me, that would be an interesting novel to write. It's not a very happy thing to live through, but it would be a rich story to tell.
There are these questions you put early on, you know, whether in this novel, you know, this narrative, whether J.D. Vance is motivated by conviction, or as you put it, is he the creature of a corrupt society? Does he deserve our admiration or our sympathy, you say, or our contempt? And so I'm wondering, what are you getting at with those questions? Just that these are the things to think about, or are you also asking whether you wonder if J.D. Vance is wholly responsible for the person that he's become?
I think he is wholly responsible. He's a grown-up. He's made a lot of decisions. They benefited him. I hold no one else responsible. I don't hold all of us responsible for J.D. Vance. He is the moral agent of his own life and has pursued it very consciously. But he also is a mirror of our society. His life shows us something about what our society has become during these 25 years of his adult life. And that's why I ask those questions about how to see him. He's absolutely responsible, but he's more interesting than that. He's more interesting than Trump. Trump is not interesting. Trump is a kind of, to me, a figure who lives below the level of moral choice, because he doesn't have ideas and he doesn't feel any moral dilemmas and he doesn't have a value system. He's just a predator. Vance thinks and has a value system. It just happens to have changed dramatically in the last few years, but he still has one. And he writes about it and talks about it. He talked about it in the Republican National Convention last year when he said that what makes him American, what America is made of, is not ideas. It's not those beautiful words of the Declaration that we're about to celebrate the 250th anniversary of. It's the home. It's the dirt. It's the soil. It's the graveyard where his ancestors are buried and he hopes he and his own children will be buried. That is blood and soil. Nationalism. That's a new kind of politics for Americans. That is America first, but it's in a really extreme form. And that's something that very few politicians at his level have ever articulated. So he's interesting in that way, more than Trump, who I don't think has these ideas.
Well, that gets us to what seems to be the part of the story that drives his upbringing. It's the, as you put it in the piece, the image of a hick struggling to survive and escape. Now, J.D. Vance himself says that he was just an ordinary person, had no real accomplishment, only managed to, you know, get out of there because of the grace of his family's love. How much of that rings true?
Yeah, that's the sort of self-deprecation that someone writing a memoir might think he has to show in order not to lose his audience from the start. I think the first sentence is something like, you may be wondering, or I'm wondering why the hell you're even reading a book like this and why I've written it. But that's really not Vance. Vance was impressive at every stage. He was impressive as a child surviving a pretty brutal upbringing with an unstable and addicted mother, in a kind of violent family atmosphere. He was impressive in the Marine Corps to his buddies. He was impressive at Ohio State, where he finished in 2 years and kind of had that escape velocity of someone who had gotten out of a really tough situation and knew that he now had a path upward. He was incredibly impressive at Yale. Here he was, as he tells us, someone who didn't even really know what seltzer water was and had to be taught by his more highborn immigrant daughter's wife or girlfriend at the time, Usha Chilukuri. She had to give him kind of a guidebook to how to survive at Yale. Yeah. He didn't really need it. because he was making friends and impressing people and speaking out in class and raising his hand, and not a great student, but a popular student, charismatic, someone who immediately people around him who'd gone to Harvard and Yale thought, this guy's going somewhere. So no, he wasn't just a kind of average hick who got some lucky breaks. He was and is a really talented thinker, writer, user of language, speaker, and networker. I think the main thing he got out of Yale was learning how to network at the highest levels through the professors he met, through his girlfriend, through his job interviews, et cetera, and through Peter Thiel, who we met at a talk that Thiel gave at Yale. So, yeah, Vance is not going to get away with telling us that if he can make it, anyone can make it, and it would just happen to be him, because most people are not J.D. Vance.
What were the ideas? You mentioned how in the military he had already been interested in political philosophy. So I'm wondering about the ideas that he was drawn to. And I think the way you write about these, the mix of the thinkers he read is so interesting. You know, considers himself a conservative, but is also drawn to Christopher Hitchens, that was striking, and Ayn Rand, and the New Atheists. Let me sort of key in on what he seems to be getting at with his interest, momentary interest anyway, in libertarianism and atheism, because you write that his ability to socialize himself into these new beliefs set a pattern for his career. Does that say that he was inquisitive and interesting, or he was just looking for a way in, you know, to be with the cool kids, to be with the in the culture that was where he would be relevant and well thought of?
I think he wanted to adapt to this new world that for him was sort of the last station, the meritocracy. It turned out not to be the last station. But when he got into Yale Law School, it seemed like it's clear sailing from here on. He wanted to adapt. He wanted to be accepted. And it's not just a matter of imitation. It's not an easy matter. It takes a lot of talent to not to mimic it, but to embrace it and to make it your own, which he did. So in a sense, he became an elite. And that's no easy thing for someone from his origins. I said in the piece that the route from his wife's parents' home in South India to Yale is shorter and more direct than from Eastern Kentucky or Southwestern Ohio. He was a long way away, and it shows you something about the incredible divide in America between the elite educated class and the less educated non-elite class. He made that leap, and it's a chasm. And again, I have to say it takes a certain talent and ambition and drive to be able to do it, and he did, but it wasn't the last one he did.
George Packer. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article, The Talented Mr. Vance, appears in this month's edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist and writer George Packer. We're talking about his profile of J.D. Vance in The Atlantic. Packer traces Vance's life story, and he uses it as a kind of allegory for American character. He tries to explain Vance's intellectual and moral evolution from a centrist idealist to a hardline political figure with complete loyalty to Donald Trump. I think it's interesting that you mentioned that he kept his dark experiences growing up in you know, working class. He kept those experiences for a while to himself, you know, stories of his abusive mother and all of that. Why do you figure – do you think he didn't intend? I'm so interested in how that turns into a book eventually, how it becomes a memoir. Why he's keeping that to himself in those early days?
Well, that's a hard question. And some of your listeners may be saying, how do you know any of this? Well, one way I know some of this is he has left such a voluminous record of his own thoughts.
Right.
Vance has never stopped talking and writing about himself. So there's a great deal of material to try to sift through to understand the questions that you're asking. I mean, it's easy to imagine that it's painful. It's shameful, perhaps, in his mind. It's just, he doesn't see it as a way to get sympathy. He sees it as or maybe he doesn't want to get sympathy. He wants to be accepted for his strengths and not for the tragedies he's endured. The other thing I would say, he didn't originally intend to write a memoir. He says he intended to write a book about what policies could help the working class, rural whites, et cetera.
Yeah.
But one of his law professors, Amy Chua, read a personal essay he'd written for her class and said, you need to write a book. So he set out on her instructions, her urging to write a book, and that became Hillbilly Elegy.
What's it like to go back and read Hillbilly Elegy now? You say it can be disorienting.
Yeah, completely disorienting. Because, you know, I read it in 2016, along with hundreds of thousands of others. And then I sort of forgot about J.D. Vance for a few years, and then he began to reappear in a very different form, sounding very different, as the one who people now know. It's the one who talks about childless cat ladies and makes up stories about Haitian immigrants eating people's pets and gets in the face of President Zelensky in the Oval Office, an aggressive sort of mocking and not, to me, not very appealing J.D. Vance. And so to go back to Hillbilly Elegy, it's honest, brutally honest. It's well-written. It's thoughtful. It doesn't have any simple answers. Every time he seems about to come up with some sort of final revelation or answer for his own or his family's or his community's problems, he complicates it. Mm-hmm. And it's modest. It's modest.
Yeah.
There's nothing aggressive about it. So it's a really strange return to someone I had forgotten. And it shows you how far he has come since the year that he published that book.
The way you put it in your piece is that the book's nuanced analysis and policy ideas might well make Vice President Vance wretch.
Yeah.
He's just not recognizable in that same way.
Yeah. He would say, oh, God, spare me your hyper-intellectual nonsense about my people. You don't know them. You know, it would be kind of repellent to him.
It's so interesting the way Vance emerges from his experience in liberal academia with what you describe as a voice perfectly tuned to moderate conservatism. I mean, the person he backed for president in 2012 was John Huntsman Jr.
I think that was who he thought he was then. I don't think it was a career move. I think he was drawn to Huntsman because Huntsman was a conservative, but he was also thoughtful and moderate and someone who looked for compromise and for true solutions to social problems and who made even Mitt Romney seem a bit extreme. So that was where Vance landed when he came out of the Ivy League. And perhaps that was the kind of conservative he was around at that time. These intellectual conservatives in Washington, D.C., who were trying to find a way to bring the Republican Party out of the dead end of George W. Bush's presidency, to sort of see social problems, questions about immigration, trade, industrialization, the environment in a more wide-lensed way, and not to be dogmatic Reagan Republicans or Bush Republicans. So that was who he was. Again, it's pretty hard to associate it with who he's become.
Well, then at Yale, as you said, he hears this speech by Peter Thiel. How important was that for the J.D. Vance we would come to know? Reckon with that. How do you understand that?
Well, I actually was spending quite a bit of time with Thiel at that very same moment in 2011 because I was writing a profile of Thiel for The New Yorker. So I know exactly what Thiel was saying at that talk he gave at Yale Law School. And it was essentially disrupting the complacency of his audience. He was saying, you all are fighting like hell and working so hard and competing with each other for a handful of these elite jobs, which will be meaningless to you and give you no real satisfaction and lead to very little contribution to our society. And the reason for this is we have become a stagnant society. Technology is stagnant. There's nothing in the world of things to compare with the airplane, the automobile, et cetera. The iPhone is nothing compared to them. So that was Thiel's pitch. And I think it spoke to Vance because Vance, having given his all to enter this Ivy League world, would almost have to wonder, what is it all for? What am I really running for? Why am I working so hard and moving so fast? And even though it didn't change anything immediately, it kind of put a thought in his head that haunted him. And when it came time to look for work, he got back in touch with Thiel. He sort of found his email address on the internet. And Thiel said, well, if you come out to Silicon Valley, look me up, which he did. And pretty soon Vance was working for Thiel. So he got inside Peter Thiel's world. And Peter Thiel, in addition to the gift of that speech at Yale, gave him a series of gifts in the coming years, most importantly, an introduction to Donald Trump and a big contribution to Vance's Senate campaign in Ohio in 2021. And so in a way, he became his new patron, a new elite who backed him once Vance essentially rejected the Yale elites who had originally backed him.
Elite anti-elitism, contempt from a position of strength is how you describe it in the piece.
Yeah. When Hillbilly Elegy came out, he told an interviewer that he has the incredible privilege of being able to be a bit of an anti-snob about the elites. But he added, if I had indulged this when I was 18, it would have been very destructive. And he might have added, and if I continue to indulge it too much, it could be even more destructive, because that has become his political card, which is the professors, the journalists, the elites, the deep state, they're the enemy. And the people are my people. They're the ones I'm fighting for. And so that's, in a sense, in a nutshell, populism, which he has embraced, I think, in a way with a kind of credibility as a son of the working class that Trump does not have.
George Packer. His article, The Talented Mr. Vance, appears in this month's edition of The Atlantic. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist and writer George Packer. He has a profile of J.D. Vance in The Atlantic. It's called The Talented Mr. Vance. So J.D. Vance writes in The Atlantic this essay where he describes Donald Trump as cultural heroin, which is what you mentioned earlier. He wondered privately if Trump was America's, you know, Hitler. Didn't vote for either major party candidate in 2016. But there's this moment you write about, I wanted to ask you about. It's election night 2016, when it starts to become apparent to the world that Donald Trump was going to become president. And ABC News turns to J.D. Vance for some perspective, to get some sense of what was going on. And George Stephanopoulos asks J.D. what it was that people were looking for from Donald Trump. Talk a little bit about that moment you write about and what J.D. Vance, how he responds and what that tells you about J.D. Vance, at least then, at the moment.
Yeah, it's a slightly comical moment for the mainstream media because suddenly they need to find a guest in, and get him into their studio who can speak about this, who they think is a spokesman for the people who voted for Trump. And Vance doesn't say, oh, I didn't vote for him. And in fact, I think he's cultural heroin and possibly America's Hitler. No, he says that they were looking for someone who saw their problems and had answers for their problems. And the media didn't believe in him, but they believed in him. So maybe they're feeling kind of vindicated. And he had a little smile on his face. So you can almost, even at that moment, begin to see the drift toward America's Hitler or toward cultural heroin at the moment of Trump's victory, when Vance, sort of being the very smart guy he is, understands that this is going to be the way to the future.
You say it took J.D. Vance a while. I mean, 4 years, I think it was, to go from, you know, never Trump to only Trump. You know, 4 years to kind of ditch one politics for another, another, you know, to make this transition. So what do you make of that? Is there – you don't identify a particular moment as a turning point. What do you make of the fact that it was gradual, that he was sort of working it out, working out the pragmatics, the how it aligned with his own ambitions? I mean, what do you make of that transition period?
I mean, I think it does say something about his seriousness. Lots of Republican politicians became overnight converts, maybe even instant converts when it became clear that their career depended on Trump. I mean, the number is legion and comical. I think Vance actually cares about policy and about political ideas and wants to have a coherent political view. And so how do you get from having said that the problem of manufacturing jobs leaving the heartland is mostly a problem of automation and education, which is kind of the elite view, to, oh, it's all about our terrible trade deals and the fact that the Republican Party is ruled by rich donors who don't care about the working class. It's not an automatic shift. You have to actually work through a series of sort of half steps before you get to the full MAGA slate of policies. And I think that did take him a few years. And maybe he also felt conflicted because he didn't want to lose everything he had just gained by becoming the elite's favorite interpreter of the white working class. And he would lose them, and he did lose them. By the time the film of Hillbilly Elegy came out in 2020, Vance had moved well away from the guy who spoke so eloquently about his book. And we'd also had 4 years of Trump. That movie was not popular with some of the same people who the book was popular with. Yeah. They turned against Vance and against his people. So he might have known that that would happen and didn't want it to happen quite so dramatically. And so he said to someone privately in 2018, I think I might vote for Trump in 2020. And that was a shock because he had been publicly so hostile to him. He began to repeat this line again and again that, well, really, Trump, if you just listen to the tone, that's only 5%, that nasty tone. Most of it's just, I want to bring jobs back to your community. 95% is about solving your problems, which is, of course, nonsense if you listen to Trump's rallies and speeches. But that became a way for Vance to sort of make it more palatable to become a Trump supporter, to say, well, you can't just listen to the rhetoric. You have to look at the ideas, the policies. So by 2020, 2021, he had abandoned never Trumpism. He had abandoned kind of libertarian conservatism, you know, the anti-government, low taxes conservatism, and had become a populist. And there it was, kind of a whole new politics waiting for him in the form of a lot of powerful people in media, in right-wing media. He also got really deeply into online media, podcasts and Twitter. And I think that influence, it became the next influence that he had to adapt to. And he adapted to it. He became a pretty vituperative figure on right-wing podcasts and social media.
Well, as you put it, the once he was able to sort of make his political ideas, you know, intellectually coherent with the sort of Trump era, that as you say, moral descent was swift and total. It's like he, after he's convinced, he really went all in. But you say, you know, look, he didn't need to go to Mar-a-Lago with Peter Thiel in early 2021 to seek his forgiveness. He didn't need to keep repeating the lie about a stolen election. He could have run for the Senate as a populist without maligning liberals and women without children and things like that. Here's another way you put it. He could have become a father without devoting a speech to mocking the childless left. So how do you explain that? That he has, in order to exist in that world, you have to go all in?
I can understand J.D. Vance deciding that he believes in tariffs, that tariffs are what the working class of the heartland need. I can even understand him thinking and saying that mass immigration has been bad for the working class and we need to limit it. But that's not all he did. He began to demonize, to lie, to amplify the biggest lie of our time, the lie of the stolen election of 2020. And I think he knows better. That's where I can't forgive him. I think he knows better. And he did it because it was the price of admission. He had a long way to go. He had to overcome that whole history of having been hostile to Trump. And he was in a hurry. He wanted to run for the Senate in 2022. And he was not going to win without Trump. He was not all that popular in Ohio. He was behind. And then because of Thiel's introduction to Trump and then Vance's friendship with Trump Jr. and his kind of schmoozing with Tucker Carlson and other right-wing figures, Trump finally decided, okay, this is the guy. So he had to go all in to show he was, as it were, more Catholic than the Pope because he was a convert. And converts have to prove that they are for real. And so he took a header into, I think, the murkiest, most noxious waters of the far right. And at this point, I haven't seen him reemerge from it. So that's how he got Trump's backing. That's how he won the Senate race in Ohio. And it's how he became Trump's pick for vice president. So it all paid off.
You write this, to succeed in the world of elites, Vance had to let himself be civilized at a psychological cost.
Yeah, imagine if your girlfriend prepares weekly kind of lessons for you in how to be a part of the Ivy League world, what you should read, what you should drink, how you should talk, how you should network, go to office hours, all those things that you just don't know if you come from Middletown, Ohio. To me, that's a very heavy burden. There's something very poignant in Hillbilly Elegy about that description of how he had to be trained. He had to be instructed, how she was, quote, my Yale spirit guide. To me, that's a painful realization. And then to be able to get rid of it and to soar, to go higher than Yale could ever bring him by throwing it aside and essentially giving a middle finger to all those law professors and journalists who he had had to cozy up to and lawyers who he had been interviewing for hiring jobs in white shoe law firms, to be able to tell them all, look at me now. How do you like me? I think there's something that must be satisfying about being able to turn his back on it.
I have to ask you about this, something you wrote in the piece, that Vance's political transformation, you say, is so complete that it's also physical. How has he been transformed physically?
Yeah, and this is again where the aspiring novelist in me sees him as this character, because you see his face in 2012 and 2016.
Yeah.
It's kind of chubby and fleshy. And there's this sort of guileless, blue-eyed charm in his eyes. The smile is warm. The way of speaking is a little apologetic almost, like, I hope I have the right to hold the floor. He's a boy. And then if you look at him now, those eyes are kind of flat. They're still blue, but they've lost that charm. They are unsmiling. He looks like a successful man, but he doesn't seem like someone you would want to sit for an hour and listen to the way audiences did back when Hillbilly Elegy came out, because he'd be jabbing a finger. He'd be getting that taunt in his voice. He'd be saying, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. And then he would proceed to demonize a whole group of Americans. So something changed in his face that reflects, because, you know, we do have the face we deserve. We have the face that our character deserves. And as his character became more the character that we've been discussing, his face became the face of that character.
You say in the piece that with his gifts, with his intellect, with his rhetoric, that he might have been able to bring the country together. But it seems as though he didn't actually think those abilities could have worked in the current environment. I mean, he seems to have calculated the country had moved in another direction, and if he was going to be relevant, that other approach, maybe where he might have gone, just wasn't going to work. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I do. I think that's right. I think that speaker from 2016, 2017, talking about his childhood, talking about his book, belongs to an era that no longer exists, because America has moved into an era of extremes, of deep mutual hatreds, of ugly public discourse, of unseriousness about ideas, and unwillingness to take the ideas of the other side seriously. And all those things would make him kind of an irrelevant figure, kind of someone who you might pat on the head but wouldn't take as someone who was going to be successful and powerful. Instead, he has understood the America he lives in and that we all live in, and he has figured out how to rise to the top in that America. And that's why the novel of J.D. Vance is a story of a country in decline. His success is our failure.
Final question. You remind readers that J.D. Vance is still only 40 years old and that he is likelier than anyone to be the next president. So let me ask you finally, what is J.D. Vance without Donald Trump? Does he have the charisma to hold the MAGA base, do you think?
I think he's become very popular with the MAGA base, precisely because he's given it everything it could want. He has said everything that it wants to hear, and he never deviates from it. But he's not Donald Trump, and he doesn't have Trump's ability to spellbind and to mesmerize. You know, he speaks in linear paragraphs and coherent sentences and doesn't come up with memorable phrases the way Trump does. And so he doesn't have those native gifts that Trump has as a showman and a salesman. So I think he's vulnerable. I think others could challenge him for the crown to be passed on, because really Trump is everything in MAGA. And without Trump, I think MAGA is going to become a bunch of warring tribes. And Vance might be the head of one of those tribes, but there'll be lots of others. I think right now, as the vice president, he is the heir apparent, but there is no guarantee about who becomes the next nominee and possibly the next president.
George Packer, thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Doug.
George Packer, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. You can find his article, The Talented Mr. Vance, in this month's edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.